Good afternoon. Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change and how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community. This program is an extension of and a production of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX. Central Coast Voices is made possible through underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. Regardless of where you sit politically, you will likely agree the past year has been far from quiet. But what impact does or will our national decisions have on local economy and residents? Today, you can join me for an update from Washington and a conversation with our congressman, with my guest, Congressman Salud Carbajal, representing the Central Coast. This show has been pre-recorded and we will not be able to take calls. However, Congressman Carbajal does have office locations in San Luis Obispo, Santa Maria, and Santa Barbara, and during the show we'll be talking a little bit about how you can reach out to him, excuse me, directly. And welcome, Congressman. It's really nice to have you here.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah. So your first year in office, and you've been bored yet?
It's never a dull moment, obviously, as everybody throughout the country is seeing. It is, I wake up some days just like anybody else who isn't in Congress and asks many of the same questions.
I'll bet you do. So let's talk a little bit about, studying for this show to come up with content was not hard. All I had to do was look at the last 6 to 7 days. So we've got a lot to talk about. So first, let's talk about something that you're talking about just today, and that really is the impact of Diablo Canyon closing. What are you kind of proposing on this, and what are you seeing as the future of assisting local residents?
Well, when you consider the devastating impact that the decommissioning or the closure of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant is going to have on the community, it is significant. And when I was running for office, it became clear to me that my number one priority was going to be to do everything possible to look at the resources at the federal government that I might be able to draw down through legislative action or through various grants or other programs to the area to ensure that some of those impacts would be mitigated. Clearly, we're looking at 1,500 jobs, well-paid jobs that would go away. The school district and county government and other governments would lose significant revenue base. And as such, in light of the agreement that was reached between PG&E and the stakeholders, there's a desire to mitigate as many of those impacts as possible. So I am looking at the federal government to see what we could do to mitigate some of those issues. And I'm very proud to have authored on the 5th of April the Energy Zones Opportunity Act, which will provide tax credit incentives to the renewable energy industries to relocate to the San Luis Obispo communities and to embark on growing their technologies and renewable energy sources so that in turn we could also see an infusion to the economy, creation of jobs, and try to mitigate some of those displaced workers and impacts that are going to be borne by the community.
What will it take to make that happen, Congressman?
Well, it means that my legislation would have to move forward to create the incentive program, the tax incentive program. And what that would do is, like I said earlier, incentivize companies to identify this area as an area where they could relocate to develop renewable energy sources. I'll give you an example. There's a company by the name of Trident that mm-hmm. is right now working with many stakeholders to explore how they might be able to develop a wind farm off our coast here in San Luis Obispo. There are some issues that they've come up against working with the United States Navy. And I've been able to put them together, and they continue to have discussions to see how they might be able to work through some of those challenges and barriers that currently exist from them being able to achieve that project.
Do you think that there's going to be the support for bills like this or acts like this to go through?
Absolutely. I believe there's been bills in the past that have promoted renewable energy, and I'm hopeful that there's bipartisan support to be able to move a similar bill or my bill forward. Keep in mind, there are other communities in both Democrat and Republican districts that are experiencing the same thing that we're experiencing here in the SLO community. And that's why I'm optimistic that if enough of us come together and there's an interest by a number of us in a bipartisan way, it may just be the perfect formula to move this legislation forward.
There seems to be, you know, is there enough interest in other states outside of California? You've probably seen the same experience that some of us have had as being non-political, in that it's almost as though lately California's had a target on its back.
Yes, there are a number of other communities, like I said, that are similar and have similar interests in this legislation moving forward. But keep in mind, there are over 120 facilities, nuclear facilities, nationwide that at some point might mm-hmm. want to close or will be scheduled to be closed. So mm-hmm. There is significant interest out there.
Okay, that's a good point. Excellent point. Now, you also have been working on a wildfire funding fix. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, traditionally, the U.S. Forest Service, when they deal with fires throughout the country, including like the Thomas Fire that we just experienced in the southern part of the district, they exhaust their firefighting budget. And after they exhaust that budget, they then have to resort to looking at other budgets within the U.S. Forest Service and raid those budgets that otherwise funding would be going towards prevention and mitigation for preventing fires. Fires are not treated like other natural disasters in our country.
How would another natural disaster be treated?
Well, a specific allocation is allocated to augment the resources that are needed to mitigate for recovery of the damage that was created by those disasters.
So that money is set aside.
That money is set aside in a fund uh-huh. to be able to draw from when we have those natural disasters.
Right.
We don't treat fires the same way we treat other disasters. And I am proud to say that at a letter that I wrote with a couple of colleagues of mine to the leadership, Republican and Democrat leadership, urging them that in this last omnibus that we ought to consider setting up a special fund to treat fires the same way we treat other disasters and stop what is called fire borrowing between funds in the U.S. Forest Service. And I am happy to report that a $20 billion fund was developed and set aside now to treat fires throughout the country and here in California as we treat other natural disasters and stop the raiding and borrowing of funds from other worthy preventative and mitigation funds in the U.S. Forest Service.
That's fantastic. So that's nationally that will take place. Will that have any impact on the individuals from the Thomas Fire, or is that going forward after those fires take place?
I believe it would. But we are in the process of getting follow-up answers to a lot of the questions that we have of, is it moving forward? How much of it could be attributed and used for the existing fire? But I believe it will impact the Thomas Fire as well.
And the fires haven't only affected California. They've been devastating in other states as well. So
absolutely. Well, I think that's why I would love to take all the credit, but I think the credit goes to a number of members throughout the country that have faced similar situations. We collectively spoke up, and as a result, we've been able to achieve this important accomplishment in the last budget.
And this was a bipartisan?
Yes. It was, the omnibus was passed in a bipartisan way. And as such, I'm very proud to say this was a bipartisan solution that we reach to be able to address this very important issue.
Given, you know, given that experience, I want to jump to what it's been like for you to be in Congress this first year.
Well, clearly, I am probably facing a unique set of circumstances as a freshman member of Congress or a first-term member of Congress.
Do you think it's different for you as a first-term as opposed to other
previous first-terms? Absolutely. I mean, we need to look no further than the Daily News and the impact and the symbiotic relationship that exists between Congress and the administration and the leadership in place right now. Mm-hmm. It has been a pretty chaotic Congress and administration. Just to give you an example, until we passed this omnibus bill, it was unheard of to have so many continuing resolutions, basically Band-Aid budgets that were developed from week to week or month to month. That, I mean, we've had continuing resolutions in the past, but not five like we had in just this one year. Clearly, the leadership in Congress, the Republican leadership, and this administration have demonstrated extraordinary chaos and a lack of continuity in adhering to regular order. So you might ask, what is regular order? Mm-hmm. Regular order means doing business where committees have hearings, where the minority party is able to offer amendments, where legislation is a work in progress, and at the end result is a product that has collaboration.
Right.
Well, because the leadership controls, the Republican leadership controls both chambers and the White House, they have not adhered to much collaboration. So, for example, bills are dropped on the floor without committee hearings, without opportunities for amendments. They do these so-called closed rule pieces of legislation where you can't even offer amendments. You have to vote it up or down based on what's brought before you.
Based on what's there.
And usually it's pretty extreme, mm-hmm. and no opportunities to amend legislation.
Did you have any idea it would be like this?
I had a sense of what to expect from my many visits to Washington representing county government and advocating for our local priorities as a county supervisor. But I never thought it would be as chaotic and erratic as I have seen. But, you know, it's like drinking from a fire hose times 10 because of the chaos that exists in Washington today. You know, the so-called swamp wasn't drained. It was multiplied.
This is Chris Kington Barker, and you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX, HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX, HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara. And you can listen to KSCBX live using your smart speaker technology by just asking your Amazon Echo, your Google Home, or other device to play KCBX. Today's Central Coast Voices is a conversation with our Central Coast Congressman, Salud Carbajal, and an update from Washington with a local focus. The voice you hear with me today is Congressman Salud Carbajal, and today's show has been pre-recorded, so we'll not have a call-in opportunity. And Congressman, we were talking about, you know, what it was like for you to be in Washington this year, so let's kind of continue with some more of the action that we've seen lately. Gun violence has been something that has been going on. We had another incident yesterday. And so you've been working to prevent gun violence and have been involved in discussions around that. Talk a little bit about what you see happening and what your involvement's been.
Well, I last May sponsored legislation called the Gun Violence Restraining Order Act. And what that legislation does is what California has done, and that is provide a tool to family members and law enforcement to work with the courts when they see somebody in crisis that is behaving in a way that poses a threat to themselves or someone else, by being able to issue a court warrant by the judge when somebody is in that state of mind and temporarily take guns away from individuals who possess guns, who find themselves in that circumstance, and not or prevent them from also buying temporarily guns. That is a piece of legislation that I have sponsored at the federal level, hoping that there's a momentum and a willingness to move that forward to emulate what we did here in California. Mm-hmm. The reason I sponsored this legislation last May before these other tragedies happened and mass shootings is because in Isla Vista in 2014, we had another tragic mass shooting that took the lives of six individuals.
Yes.
And I felt it was important to continue to advocate and keep and provide more tools to communities and states that would be able to do what California has been able to achieve. Having said that, with all the tragedies that we recently experienced, I'm hoping that what's going to make a difference this time is the youth that are speaking out. I think that's going to make a big difference, and I'm hoping the momentum leads us to accomplishing not just gun violence restraining order bills. My bill would actually provide incentive grants to states and local municipalities to adopt gun violence restraining order laws and programs. But I'm hoping that this momentum leads to banning assault rifles. I was in the Marine Corps. Those weapons should not be on our streets. They're not used for hunting. They're just weapons for killing. And they should be banned like we once had here in the United States. Mm-hmm. We actually used to have a ban that expired and wasn't reauthorized.
On assault rifles?
Yes, on assault rifles.
I did not know
and
that.
And we need to bring that back. Senator Feinstein was the one who approved and brought that legislation forward that was approved many years ago. But when it expired, there wasn't the will to reauthorize it or renew it. We also need to institute universal background checks to stop individuals who are who have criminal backgrounds, who also possess mental challenges that reflect that they are a danger to themselves and others from not being able to purchase guns. We need to make sure that we institute those types of measures, as well as high-capacity magazines need to be banned as well. So those are just a few items that we need to do to create a safer country and to prevent those who shouldn't be having guns from owning or purchasing guns.
When you talk about universal background checks, the people on the other side of that would say, well, we've got background checks now, and the individuals that are using these guns and getting these guns aren't going to buy them in a place that they're going to be able to have a check anyway. So it's not going to make a difference. What is a universal background check as opposed to background checks that we're doing now?
Well, universal background checks would actually create a database that would allow not only law enforcement agencies, but those stores that are trying to sell their wares know that certain individuals are precluded from purchasing those guns, so they wouldn't have access to purchasing those weapons. And implementing such a database and a program would work in a way that I think would be effective.
Do people who go to gun shows, do they have background checks before they purchase guns at gun shows?
I don't believe so.
I don't.
But
think so
but those types of issues would be addressed in such a database and such in the law, so that you would not have these loopholes where whether it's on the internet or at gun shows, you'd be able to do that.
What do you think is preventing, with all the violence that's going on and yet another shooting, and and there are statistics that come out about we are at the top of the list of countries that have this kind of gun violence outside of war. What do you think is preventing?
Well, I think we need to be frank. It's the NRA. The NRA has become a very powerful lobby, and they dispense huge amounts of money to individuals running for office. And I think there's been a reluctance to pass sensible gun safety laws as a result. And, you know, it's created such an environment that the NRA has been synonymous with a new slogan. No Republican action is the NRA. It's very similar because, you know, there's just not a will or desire to move sensible legislation forward. There are a few Republicans that I think are open to sensible gun laws. For instance, I'm looking at sponsoring a straw purchase bill. It would make straw purchases illegal with a Republican colleague of mine in Congress. So there is an interest by some Republicans for some sensible gun law. So I don't want to paint them all with the same brush, but the leadership is not allowing any of these to move forward. With my GVRO, for example, has over 96 sponsors, my Gun Violence Restraining Order Act bill, and I believe four or five are Republicans.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, what is the next step with that bill? Where does that go?
It would go to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay.
And then after that, obviously, it would come to the floor. But just getting a hearing on the Judiciary Committee is the first and challenge that we need to overcome.
There's been discussion on both sides, however, about trying to keep guns out of the hands of people that are mentally unstable or have demonstrated violence towards another person or express that.
So, or domestic violence.
Domestic violence, yes. Correct. So, and you're talking about having a bill that would do that temporarily, so it's not extracting that on a permanent basis.
And have due process for individuals.
And have due process. So I would think that that would have more popularity than it saying has, you cannot have a
In light weapon. Of the recent tragedies that we've seen, that has gotten some momentum and popularity, as you put it. But still hasn't achieved the type of momentum that we need to have to put it over the finish line. But like I said, I'm hoping that our youth that are speaking out across the country from Parkland and other communities will make a difference this time.
And speaking of the youth, you were there in March for Our Lives.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about what that experience was like for you and what you saw.
Well, I was just so encouraged by the energy and the passion and the proactive engagement and activism by our young people. It was great to see them speak out about something that has affected many of their lives. And to say we're not gonna take this. Take sensible action, Congress, that protects the lives of schools, that protects the lives of young people and people throughout our country, not just themselves. I don't think they were being so selfish that it was just about them and schools. I think they were speaking about gun violence in general. Mm-hmm. And I thought they were awesome. It was just exhilarating to see such energy and engagement.
When you go back with your colleagues in Washington, what kind of is the take there? What's the flavor there in terms of how they're viewing on both sides?
Well, the momentum ebbs and flows. I don't know if you recall the tragedy we experienced in Las Vegas.
Yes.
Well, after that, this president and leadership said, we're going to pass bump stock legislation. And then after a week or two, it wasn't in the forefront anymore, and they never did anything. This time around, they said, oh, we're going to pass GVRO legislation. We're even going to go back to the bump stock and pass finally legislation on that. And it hasn't gone anywhere. So a lot of lip service is given by this Republican leadership and this president. But on a dime, overnight, they changed their tune. And, you know, this president was talking a big game and saying he was going to do things. And then had a meeting with the NRA and did an about face, 180-degree turn. It is, for me, it's so appalling. And I find it so disingenuous that people, when there's a tragedy, speak up in Congress. And then a few days later, they just don't continue that advocacy and that commitment that we need to have to get those laws enacted and over the finish line.
Now, I'm really curious because my understanding was, and perhaps this was fake news, but my understanding was after the incident that took place on the plane where the dog was put in the carrier, there was an actual bill that was passed that prevented that from happening. Is that correct?
I believe some legislation was introduced. I need to go back and refresh my memory with where that bill is and whether it's come to. I don't believe it's come to the floor.
Oh, it hasn't come to.
Not that I know. I'll double check. But
right away, a bill was written about the dog, like the next day, about dogs in carriers. Yet we've had people who have been dying all over the place.
No, it's, you know, we're an industrialized nation. And, you know, we look at other industrialized nations, England, we look at Australia, and they have been able to pass sensible gun laws that respect, as in our country, respect the Second Amendment, but still be able to move forward with sensible gun safety laws.
Yeah, but they've had people that were willing to put the guns away, too.
That's true.
Yeah. So you were born in Mexico.
Yes.
And immigrated here very young.
Mm-hmm.
You were how old?
I was 5 years old.
5 years old. And you spoke English or didn't speak English?
Well, I learned English here.
You learned English here?
Yes. I didn't speak English when I got here.
Okay.
I still remember my teacher a year later saying how shocked she was that I learned English, I think, within a year.
Yeah.
I guess as a child, we're sponges. We learn it really quick.
Yeah. Five is a great age to learn. So the DACA discussion and that whole ping pong game has got to have some personal meaning to you, too.
Absolutely. But, you know, it's this president undid the executive order that President Obama put in place to provide opportunity and a reprieve for individuals who fall within that category of DACA. And this president just did away with it and tried to say that he was putting this responsibility on Congress. Again, his party controls both chambers. They control the White House. And the leadership, short of McConnell, having brought forward a little discussion about possibly addressing the DACA issue, the House leadership, Speaker Ryan, has not brought forward any of the bipartisan DACA bills that have been introduced.
They haven't moved to the floor.
He has not allowed them to come to committee or the floor. And we have many bipartisan bills that would fix DACA, and yet they're not allowed to come to the floor. So this president and this majority Republican leadership have given, again, a lot of lip service like gun control and won't allow bipartisan solutions that exist today to move forward, let alone addressing comprehensive immigration reform.
Right. Now, I thought that there was a Supreme Court temporary ruling that DACA recipients could file for renewal.
There has been a stay by the Supreme Court that has basically said that they're not taking on this case that President Trump wanted them to consider to resolve the DACA lower court decision.
Okay.
But they basically said the lower courts have to deal with this. But until such time, the program continues to exist. So there is a continued reapplication of individuals who want to continue to stay in DACA until those courts resolve those decisions.
So this could go on for how long?
You know, it could go on with all the deliberations and the court hearings. I am informed that it's likely it could go on till 2019.
Wow. With people sitting not knowing one way or
yes.
the other.
Well, the good news is that the program continues. The bad news is it continues to bring anxiety and no clarity to these individuals who are currently DACA and creates a state of limbo. And it's really, really unfair and unfortunate when Congress has the ability to move forward bipartisan legislation that already exists. It just isn't being done.
Right. This is Chris Kington, and I'm your host on KCBX Public Radio, airing from Salinas to Santa Barbara and around the globe on the web at kcbx.org. My guest for today's show is Congressman Salud Carbajal, who's sharing his perspective on his first year in Congress and the efforts he's been making on behalf of all of us on the Central Coast. This show has been pre-recorded, and so we don't have a call-in capacity today. And you mentioned, Congressman, that you're a veteran.
Yes.
And you were a Marine?
Yes.
Yes. And the VA has been in the news again. Some changes in administration of the VA. There's been discussion about whether to privatize, whether privatization of healthcare is a good thing or a bad thing. As you know, as a veteran and as somebody who's been involved now for a year, watching a little bit of the flow, have you had a time to think about some of that?
Well, clearly, I think the Shulkin, who was there before, was trying to implement some reforms to streamline and make the VA system and programs work better.
Right, because there were real issues with it.
Yeah. And there continues to be some issues.
Yeah.
It's a good system that could be better, and that's why we need to look at continued reforms to improve programs and services to our veterans. But privatizing and rushing to privatize is not the answer. Usually that's the Republican leadership's answer to fixing anything is, let's privatize it. Well, I think you could look at a number of actions and ways of fixing things, but to rush to privatization isn't the correct fix. I think we need to look at all options.
When we're talking about privatization, for people that don't understand what that means, you know, and sometimes I'm kind of questioning what people are talking about when they say, let's privatize the VA. What are they talking about?
Well, you know, what comes to mind is rationing of services that otherwise would be available to veterans.
So creating that's
really
an
what
HMO.
It comes down. It means not giving the veterans the type of care that they deserve. Certainly, we could look at ways to make it more cost-effective, to make it more streamlined, so that services are delivered in a more effective manner. Mm-hmm. But again, we need to look at all the strategies to achieve that, not just rush to privatization as if that's the answer. We have seen that in our healthcare system, sometimes insurance companies have the bottom line and their ratepayers as their motivating missions, not the services that are provided to individuals. We have a responsibility to make sure that the best care is provided to our veterans, not to shareholders of insurance companies.
When we've been watching stock markets go up and down, we've been watching battles back and forth now about taxing. You know, trade that's coming in, trade that's going out. There's been disputes back and forth with China, discussions about what we're going to tax, what they're going to tax. And a lot of that has an impact on the Central Coast. Some of the goods that are coming out of here, specifically strawberries and the grape industry or the wine industry, huge impact on that with some of the taxation now. What are you hearing from some of your constituents?
Well, what I'm hearing a lot from the agriculture community in the 24th Congressional District is their concern about not only these tariffs and what it could mean for them being able to sell their products,
right,
as they have been doing internationally, and how that's going to impact their businesses in a negative way. But I have also been hearing about the shortage of labor. And the fact that not moving forward with comprehensive immigration reform that would solve this labor shortage that they are facing are two of the big issues that I've been hearing. And yet, again, this administration is doing nothing to address the labor shortage and comprehensive immigration reform. I think it's taking a shotgun approach to enacting tariffs without a game plan that is going to create instability in our own economy, our own workforce, and many of our industries who are going to be greatly impacted. Certainly, we should always strive for fair trade. But fair trade is done in a methodical, bilateral, multilateral agreements with multi-stakeholders, and to make sure we achieve trade that is in the best interest of all parties, and especially our country. But you can't willy-nilly do it as this administration has started to do. Keep in mind that this president oftentimes speaks about enacting or doing away with certain trade agreements. He forgets that Congress is the one that has a big role in that regard, and he can't do it as he claims he can. So sometimes he needs to be reminded that he doesn't have the power that he claims or espouses to have. Certainly he could impact it because he has a significant amount of latitude and discretion, but he doesn't have the ability to do away with NAFTA like he thinks he does.
So in order for NAFTA to go away, it would have to be voted out by whom?
By Congress.
By Congress.
But this president can impact it,
of course,
in a negative way. But
sure,
ultimately, it's not just his decision to make.
Yeah.
And he forgets that there's that little separate entity called the legislative process and Congress that have a decision here. He's not emperor or king.
So if you were looking in your crystal ball and you're seeing now what's happening with people getting nervous about some of the tariffs back and forth and some of the concerns about what the impact would be if NAFTA would be thrown out, do you think that some of this has the impact of perhaps individuals who were maybe previously aligned to say, yeah, we should just go ahead and throw that out, now starting to say, well, wait a minute, maybe we need to be a little more cautious about that?
I think people understand that this is a lot more complex than meets the eye or is characterized by certain individuals. And if not done right, this could have devastating impacts on our various business sectors, various industries, and certainly our economy. That's why you saw Wall Street and the S&P dive in the last couple of days, because they are nervous that this is going to bring instability, chaos to our economy and put us on a nosedive to financial ruin as a country. Again, this is not playing with marbles.
No.
This president needs to wake up and understand that this is a very methodical, careful process that needs to be adhered to reach the best outcomes for our country, for our economy, and for all our industries.
When you spoke about the workforce and some of the lack of personnel or lack of being able to find individuals to fill those workforce positions, as our unemployment rate goes down, it becomes even more difficult. Are you hearing this from the farming industry, from the agriculture industry right now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think a year ago we had, a $13 million loss of crops due to labor shortages.
Meaning they just couldn't get
picked. Couldn't get the labor, or harvest it. And I think this last year there was another $16 million $16 million in losses as a result of labor again. So these aren't just hypothetical. These are tangible things that are happening mm-hmm. in our communities.
Mm-hmm. What else are you hearing? Because I know you're going out to, when you're back here on the Central Coast, you're meeting with constituents. You've started setting up, go out and speak and sharing information. What are you hearing from people that they're concerned about?
I think a gamut of issues. People have expressed an interest or concern about the Diablo Canyon, the Diablo nuclear facility closure, and concern about what that's going to do to the local economy and the loss of jobs and the revenue base for local schools and government services. And so that's an issue that has come up over and over again. individuals concerned about immigration, individuals concerned about our education system, making sure that higher education continues to be affordable and accessible to people. I think people are concerned about healthcare, making sure that, again, healthcare isn't continually eroded by this administration and Congress. And also that economic opportunities continue for middle-class working families in our area. I'll give you an example of devastating impacts that are going to be experienced in our region and throughout the country. This Congress and this president recently mustered the votes to pass their tax reform plan. And what they forgot to tell the American people is that 83% of the benefit is going to the top 1% wealthiest individuals in our country, the top 1%. And whatever small benefit was going to be given to middle-class working families, it's going to expire in 2025. And lastly, they took away the individual mandate of the Affordable Care Act that is one of the legs on the three-legged stool that continue to keep that program viable and solvent. 3 million people, as a result of that tax plan, are going to lose their health insurance. And we're not going to be able to see a robust infusion into our economy like people are saying. Right. Companies are taking those bonuses and whatever breaks they're getting, and they're not necessarily reinvesting it in wages to address the economic and wage divide that we are experiencing in our country. We're not seeing any of that come to light as was promised. Mm-hmm. All we're seeing is that opportunities for the middle class and working families are being taken away and shifted to the wealthiest corporations and 1% in our country.
Do you think that as things start to even feel more unstable or stocks start to dip, rise, that companies will tend to try and hang on to that money even more as a way of banking it away for an unknown future rather than sharing it with employees or increasing wages?
Do you think shareholders are going to say to many of those corporations or companies, don't give me more profit, give it to the workers? What do you think the answer is going to be?
Gee, that's a hard one, huh? Yeah. Yeah. I'm Chris Kington-Varger with you on Central Coast Voices on KCBX. Central Coast Public Radio. If you just joined us and you want to hear this entire show, all local shows on KCBX are available on demand by going to kcbx.org and clicking on demand under How to Listen tab on our menu. Just select the show you want on the drop-down menu. My guest today is Congressman Salud Cobrahal, and he is the congressional representative in Washington for all of us on the Central Coast. He is giving us his perspective of his first year and his thoughts about the future. This show has been pre-recorded. And let's talk a little bit about the census. That was another thing that came up this week. See, there's no shortage of things, is there? So the census now that's been proposed that it be asked whether or not a person is a citizen when they are doing the census. And the impact of that is felt that in some areas, individuals may avoid taking the census. It actually is illegal to not answer all the questions on the census. Whether people, you know, would actually be prosecuted for something like that is, you know, debatable. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the reason we have the census is for apportionment and to make sure that we understand how many people are in our country, apportionment of boundaries for subdivisions of government in terms of congressional seats, and also to understand how funding should be allocated to communities based on per capita. And so it's important for everyone to be counted. And keep in mind that our Constitution, certainly we should always protect our borders, but for those individuals that are here, our Constitution is extended. The rights of our Constitution are extended to individuals who reside in the United States, citizens and non-citizens alike. And as such, when we are looking at populations, we want to understand as a country the number of individuals that live, that exist in our country and where they live, so that apportionment of those boundaries could be done right, and that when division of resources are divided and spent in communities, they have a sense of what those resources should mm-hmm. be and allocations. Asking that question, I think, gets into, I think, to the heart of what the reason why some people want to ask it. And that is to scare anybody who's not a citizen to not answer it so that they are not counted, and therefore minimizes their existence and their importance and their rights that exist in this country to them as, you know, even permanent legal residents or anybody else. So it is really a tool and a tactic that is being used by this administration to minimize the count, the appropriate count, of individuals that live in this country.
Do you think it would have a impact if that goes through in your areas of representation?
Absolutely. Again, it goes back to the distribution of resources to our community. Mm-hmm. The Constitution will say it doesn't matter who you are. If you show up to a emergency room, you have to be treated no matter who you are. Our schools have to enroll every child no matter who you are. And to not be able to recognize all individuals that live in all communities would be a shortchanging of the resources that are owed to every community in this country under the Constitution of the United States.
And the impact of that, on top of a decline in tax benefits or tax income from Diablo, could be pretty devastating.
I would say so.
Yeah. So we've talked about a lot of things that are on the negative side. What are some of the positive things
Great.
That people can do and that you're doing?
Well, let me just share with you there. You know, despite the chaos and the toxic partisanship that exists, there's also some glimmers of hope. And I am proud to say that I am part of the Problem Solvers Caucus. Which is
that an actual caucus?
That is an actual caucus.
I love that.
And it's made up of half of the membership is Republican and half are Democrats. We have about 48 to 50 individuals that are a part of this caucus. And we have adhering guiding principles and bylaws that stipulate that we will do everything possible to find common ground on various major issues, whether it's healthcare, immigration, you name it. And we have been able to do that, even gun control, to identify parameters or guiding principles or legislation mm-hmm. that we can support to push our parties to move beyond this partisanship that exists in Washington and try to work together, starting from that common ground. And so I'm proud to be part of this bipartisan group to try to get away from this toxic partisanship that exists in Washington. You know, that's been one of my most disappointing things about going to Washington, this partisanship that exists and gamemanship that exists between both parties. It almost seems that instead of putting the American public and interests and issues and challenges that we need to solve first, the gamemanship of the of the partisanship puts party over country.
Yeah.
And I think it's really a travesty and unfortunate. And that's why I'm doing my small part to try to work towards finding common ground and creating an environment of civility where we may disagree or agree to disagree, but we don't demagogue each other. We actually try to find a civil environment where we have mutual respect that will lead to some common ground and hopefully creating a better working environment than the chaos and the uncivil and silly gamemanship, partisan gamemanship that exists in Washington.
How many people are in this caucus?
About 50, 48 to 50. We're trying to grow it.
Has it been growing since it started? Do you have
yes,
people
I remember
that have
joined? When it was 30. Now it's, again, 48 or
Great.
50. The other group that I'm proud to be part of is the Climate Solutions Caucus.
Talk about that.
It's a bipartisan group that has about 78 members, half Republicans, half Democrats, and we are striving to find common ground on issues that pertain to climate change and environmental protection. And there's a few pieces of legislation and issues that we've been able to try to work on collectively that I think demonstrate that common ground. There's also been a few bad pieces of environmental legislation and anti-climate change legislation that have come to the floor that I'm proud to say, if it wasn't for this bipartisan group, and even though Republicans are in the leadership right now, a few of them defecting and being part of this group and adhering to these principles, we were able to not allow some bad legislation to move forward. So there are some glimmers of hope in Washington that I'm glad exists and I'm glad that I'm a part of.
I think that's great. And it must feel with these two caucuses, too, like it's a little bit of respite for you from kind of the environment that almost would seem a little toxic. I know sometimes when I listen to the news, I feel like I need to wear a bite guard. So I can only imagine that being in the midst of it, sometimes it's got to be tense.
It is. But, you know, I tend to be an optimist. Mm-hmm. So I'm hopeful that there are better days ahead. And that's why I'm there. I think you have to be an optimist to be in Congress, or else you would get depressed really quick and you would take your marbles and go home really quickly.
So how do you want to hear from your constituents? How do you, how can we as individuals get to you to tell you what's important to us?
They could contact my office and in various ways. They could call my office here in the district, either Santa Barbara, San Luis, or Santa Maria. They could contact my office in Washington, either by email, phone calls, letters, petitions, all of the above. They could catch me at one of the many public events that I go to, or my sidewalk office hours that I do, not necessarily in the office, but out at supermarkets, out at farmers markets. I've done a number of those.
I saw you did a one recently in Goleta, right?
Yes, and yeah. I also did one at a farmers market.
Oh, you did?
Here in SLO a few weeks ago. You know, I love just getting out there and providing not only the formal avenues where people could contact my office, you know, phone calls, petitions, emails, letters, but I love engaging people on a one-on-one informally at in informal settings, coffee
yeah.
shops, the market, creating opportunities that are non-traditional that people could feel more comfortable approaching me and my staff. They could reach my office here in San Luis Obispo. My office is at 1411 Marsh Street, Suite 205, and the phone number is 546-8348. That's my office address and phone number here in San Luis Obispo. And of course, I have an office in Santa Barbara on Hope Street, 360 South Hope Avenue, Suite C301 in Santa Barbara. And the phone number there is 730-1710. And that is the same phone number for the Santa Maria office that we have as well.
When people, you know, when we get things like write your congressman about this, and we send a letter to you, and I've written a lot of letters to you about things that are important to me. Do you get them?
Yes. Well, I get thousands.
You probably don't remember
so
mine.
I get thousands. So yeah. I get to as many as I can, but my staff compile and collate them.
Mm-hmm.
So I can tell you this week I got 1,000 letters, 300 emails, 200 calls, and on the issues and reasons that individuals contacted my office. So I can give you those big aggregate numbers.
So does it make a difference when you're going in to vote on something?
If absolutely.
You're hearing from people about, hey, wait a minute, there's this piece of legislature that's coming up that you're going to make a decision on, and this is important to me because...
Absolutely. When I hear, it's obvious, obviously. If I get 700 phone calls,
yeah,
or 800 letters,
yeah,
or 2,000 letters,
yeah,
it wakes me up. I'm like, right. Hey, this is something that we're hearing from.
Right,
you need to really give that more consideration and give as you consider this piece of legislation. So, absolutely, my staff and I are consistently reviewing, exploring, and collating and tabulating the number of calls, petitions, emails, letters we've gotten on any one issue. And earlier I mentioned the Santa Maria office.
Yeah.
The Santa Maria office is at 1619 South Thornberry Street. And the phone number there is the same one as the Santa Barbara phone number,
730-1710.
It's Thornburg.
Thornburg.
Yes, I don't know why I said
1619
South Thornburg Street. Not Thornberry.
So we have about a minute. Is there anything you want to make sure that you say that we didn't talk about?
I think we touched on a lot of things. I will just say that I think more than ever, it is important for individuals that want to see their voices heard in Washington, that they speak up, that they continue to be engaged, that they let me and my colleagues know what's important to them, because it's more important than ever to understand what keeps people up at night and what's important to people.
Yeah, exactly. And the way to do that is go to one of your sidewalk things, go to the office, call, write you.
Emails, letters.
Emails, however you can
postcards,
do it.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. I want to thank my guest for today's show, Congressman Salud Carbajal. Next week, please join me for an interview with Dr. Karen Wyatt, a physician, author, and founder of the online and podcast at End of Life University, as we talk about National Healthcare Decisions Day and a 10-day challenge that can change your life and the life of others. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX, and made possible through underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent. Your suggestions and comments for future shows are always appreciated. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for joining me on Central Coast Voices.